From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
It's no wonder that this government would be against the International Criminal Court because they'd be perpetual defendants at it. There is an evil strain in our international conduct, from assassination, destabilization, to fomenting war. That's our legacy around the world, particularly with people of color.
As Secretary of Defense William Cohen returns from Indonesia, we'll examine the U.S.-Indonesian military relationship with journalist Alan Nairn, who's just returned from detention in Indonesia. Also, as dozens are arrested in Minneapolis for resisting the building of a road through Native American territory, we'll talk to the Minnehaha Nation. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The number of Americans who lack health insurance continued to increase last year, climbing to 44.3 million in spite of a prosperous economy and recent government efforts to expand coverage. The ranks of the uninsured grew by about 1 million in 1998, this according to figures to be released today by the Census Bureau, which shows the proportion of people in the United States without coverage is still 1 in 6. And this latest news internationally, refugees and pro-independence East Timorese guerrillas urge multinational troops today to deploy more rapidly along the border with West Timor to help get aid to the area. They said they had seen little sign in recent days of the pro-Jakarta militias who took brutal revenge after the territory voted overwhelmingly for independence from Indonesia on August 30th. A multinational force is in East Timor to restore peace but has yet to establish bases in this southwestern area. The Indonesian president, B.J. Habibie, said today he's ready to deliver his accountability speech outlining his performance and achievements to the top legislative body ahead of the October 20th presidential election. And this news from Springfield, Illinois. It's being called a landmark decision on HMO reform. The Illinois Supreme Court has ruled that patients may sue health maintenance organizations alleged malpractice. The decision stems from the case of a Chicago woman who sued her HMO, claiming doctors failed to diagnose her cancer quickly enough. She has since died. A circuit court had ruled the woman could not sue the HMO because the doctors were independent contractors. The state Supreme Court of Illinois, however, disagreed, saying the HMO can be held responsible. And this news from Atlanta. Lawyers for Coca-Cola are denying claims that company officials shredded potential evidence in a discrimination suit against them. But they say Coke did consider putting a shredder in a room containing documents in the case. Four current or former Black Coke employees are suing the company for alleged racial discrimination. Their lawyers say they had substantial evidence that the room where Coca-Cola was working on the suit had shredders that destroyed information. Coca-Cola officials say they once discussed the possibility of using shredders in a data collection room, but the idea was, quote, immediately vetoed. The FBI is investigating the slaying of a Black carjacking suspect by a Hispanic officer who has shot and killed three other people in 15 years. The Miami police said Sergeant Juan Mendez fired 7 shots at Antonio Butler, hitting him twice as the unarmed 19-year-old tried to climb a fence to get away September 20th. Mendez had spotted Butler driving a car that had been stolen at gunpoint the night before. The officer, who's been reassigned to a desk job while the department investigates, killed 3 Latino suspects in the line of duty. Internal investigators claim the shootings were justified. The U.S. Attorney's Office said the FBI was brought into the investigation after Florida Democratic Congressmember Carrie Meek wrote a letter to Attorney General Janet Reno expressing concern about Mendez's record and racial profiling by police. Last Monday, more than 300 demonstrators snarled traffic outside the police department as they demanded Mendez be fired. The Miami branch of the NAACP has also denounced the shooting. And a 41-year-old white man was arrested on federal charges and two bombings at predominantly black Florida A&M University, the FBI says today. Lawrence Michael Lombardi, an unemployed father of two from Tallahassee, was arrested about 4:30 this morning after agents searched his home. He was charged with a single count of manufacturing a bomb, pending formal charges later. Two small explosions have gone off at the campus since August 31st. No one was injured in either blast, but strident racist telephone calls accompanied each incident and warned of further attacks, spreading fear on the 12,000-student campus. And this news from South Africa. A military surgeon dubbed Dr. Death for his apartheid-era germ and chemical warfare campaign against blacks went on trial in Pretoria today on 64 charges ranging from 200 murders to drug dealing. Wouter Basson, a 49-year-old cardiologist who still operates at the South African Army's Pretoria Hospital, smiled at reporters and winked at a black cameraman as he arrived in the Pretoria High Court for what's expected to be a two-year trial.
Way down yonder in the mini-apple where sprawl is a major crop. Department of Transportation's planned a road to a favorite park. For 40 years they've tried to clear this path where we don't want one. Now in this little neighborhood in an old oak wood they've run into a little problem. Not gonna take these houses for a highway. Not gonna harm one limb on these old trees. From now on, this project's going my way. Someone please inform the DOT. The Minnehaha Hiawatha, the highway stays in its place. Minnehaha Hiawatha, oh, will stay right in your face. Come on over, stop the dozers, not afraid to barricade. Keep spouses in their houses, the politicians are all louses. They don't stop the reroute right away.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, that song about the Minnehaha Nation. We'll find out what the police raid has been all about in that Native American part of this country. That's later in the show. But right now, the head of United Nations-backed intervention force in East Timor says he's asked the Indonesian military to make four of its officers available for questioning about the murder of a Dutch journalist 2 weeks ago, who was the correspondent for London's Financial Times. He said there has not yet been a response. Sander Tunis was killed shortly after international forces arrived in East Timor when he was driving through Dili on the back of a motorcycle. Although many had first reported that the killing had been done by Indonesian-backed militias, the driver of the bike told journalists the attack had been carried out by men in Indonesian army uniforms. Meanwhile, the commander of the pro-independence Timorese rebel group Volunteer has accused the international forces of taking too long to bring the territory under control so that desperately needed aid can get through to hundreds of thousands of desperate Timorese. And as we speak, William Cohen, the Secretary of Defense, has coming back from Indonesia to the United States. He supposedly was there to deliver a strong message to Wiranto, the general in charge of the armed forces of Indonesia, to stop the violence in East Timor. Joining us right now to talk about the latest news from East Timor is Alan Nairn. Alan was bringing us daily dispatches from Dili at the time leading up to the August 30th referendum, the historic vote in which Timorese, hundreds of thousands of them, voted overwhelmingly for independence. Afterwards, a bloodbath took place as Indonesian military and their militias razed the country, destroyed the country, burned, looted, killed. Still, we don't know how many people forcibly deported hundreds of thousands of Timorese out of the country. Hundreds of thousands other Timorese ran up into the mountains, and it's not clear how many thousands have been forced into other parts of Indonesia. Alan was arrested as one of the last journalists in East Timor on the early morning of September 14th. Our listeners who listen regularly know his story, arrested in East Timor. He was in East Timor in Indonesia despite an army ban placed on him since 1991 when he survived a massacre there in which Indonesian soldiers gunned down more than 250 Timorese using U.S. weapons. But Alan has defied the ban a number of times since that time. This time he was arrested, brought from East Timor to West Timor, interrogated repeatedly, watched as the militias worked with the military in the command posts he was held in. He was then told he would be charged and face 10 years in prison, but ultimately was deported from Indonesia and has just returned to the United States, returned, in fact, last Thursday afternoon in time to testify before a House Subcommittee on Human Rights hearing on East Timor. Xanana Gusmão, the rebel leader of East Timor, and José Ramos Horta first spoke. And then in the second panel, journalist Alan Nairn outlined the U.S.-Indonesian military relationship to this day. And he joins us in the studios today. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alan, and welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be with you. And also thank your listeners for the calls that helped to spring me from Indonesia. That was good.
Well, it really is a testament to what grassroots activism is all about, that's for sure. Well, Alan, you made some stunning charges on Thursday afternoon as you had just returned from Indonesia about U.S. complicity in the backing of the Indonesian military, particularly relevant today as William Cohen, the Secretary of Defense, returns from Indonesia. Can you lay out for us what that U.S. relationship is and what you have discovered in the last 4 months that you have been in Indonesia and in Indonesia-occupied East Timor?
Well, the conventional wisdom in Washington today is that the U.S. military relationship with Indonesia is minimal and that training for the Indonesian army and police has been cut off. Neither one is true. It's also the case that in recent months, as the army terror has escalated in Aceh and as the militia operation has ravaged East Timor, and as the State Department and White House have been publicly criticizing the Indonesian military and saying that the U.S. was distancing itself from that military, behind the scenes, the Pentagon has been, on the level of substance, moving in the opposite direction, has been drawing closer to the Indonesian military, and has been promising them a still closer relationship in the near future.
Our listeners may remember about 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, as the UN was abandoning East Timor, you were broadcasting a report that was published in The Nation magazine about one Admiral Dennis Blair, head of the Pacific Command, and what his role has been in maintaining the U.S.-Indonesian military relationship. Can you summarize that for us and then go beyond, as you did in the testimony on Thursday, that so enraged Congress members, both Republican and Democrat, that they are now calling, hoping to subpoena Pentagon officials to demand a response?
Yes, Admiral Blair is the top U.S. military commander in the Pacific. He's the CINCPAC, Commander-in-Chief Pacific. On April 18, on April 8th, Blair was sent to Jakarta to meet with General Wiranto. He had the mission of telling Wiranto to shut the militias down. This was a mission that the State Department thought they had given him as a result of the pressure they had received from Congress. But Blair, in the meeting with Wiranto, essentially did the opposite. He offered him new U.S. military assistance. He did not mention the Likisa militia massacre, which had taken place 2 days earlier, in which militiamen armed with machetes and uniformed Bree mob troops had massacred dozens of refugees in the Likisa church. Blair, in this meeting with Wiranto, in his only reference to the militias, implied that Wiranto was being unfairly criticized for the militia operation. And he even offered to join, he even offered that the Pentagon would join with the Indonesian military in lobbying the U.S. Congress to change standing U.S. policy and get the IMET military training aid restored. IMET is the military training that was cut off after the 91 Dili massacre. Blair also offered Wiranto a whole new training program, the first new program since 92, this one training in crowd control techniques, which would, as it happened, focus on the BRIMOB, the very unit that 2 days before had helped to commit the Likisa massacre. Wiranto, to say the least, was delighted with this. He took it as a green light to intensify the militia operations, and they did just that. Now there is new information that I spoke about.
How do you know that, by the way, that that's in fact what Dennis Blair said, the admiral?
Well, that's according to the classified cable with a detailed summary, Pentagon summary of the meeting between Wiranto and Blair. So this is all based on the official internal document. Now there's new information about a later meeting involving Admiral Archie Clemons, who is the commander of the Pacific Fleet. He's the top naval commander in the region. On July 14, he went to the Indonesian Training Command and Naval Academy and made a presentation in which he broke new political ground. Now, this was at a time, remember, when the militia terror had increased substantially. It was much worse than it was in April. By this time, the U.S. was publicly saying that it was pulling away from the Jakarta military. But in his presentation to the senior officers, Admiral Clemons said several remarkable things. One, he said that the U.S. wanted to establish, in essence, a new base in Indonesia, a training base to be located in Surabaya, near the headquarters of the Indonesian Navy Eastern Fleet. This would be a base in which U.S. troops could come in and do training exercises. Now, in Indonesian politics, this is a very hot issue. At this time, even though the army is sponsored by Washington, there are no U.S. bases on Indonesian soil, yet Clemons was broaching that possibility. Second, in his presentation, Clemons offered the Indonesian military new U.S. High-tech equipment, naval communications and surveillance gear. He urged them to purchase that equipment and use it to integrate their own electronics with those of the U.S. Navy. So on two fronts, he was talking about an unprecedented advance in the intimacy between Washington and the Indonesian armed forces at the very time that they were terrorizing Aceh and Timor. And this also is based on internal Pentagon documents, as well as the account of Indonesian officers who were there as Clemons spoke.
You know, this is interesting, Alan, in light of Secretary of Defense William Cohen coming back right now and what it is he actually said to Wiranto. Just last week when we read the reports from Reuters and Associated Press, the news wires, they were completely contradictory. Associated Press said that Cohen had delivered a very strong message to the Indonesian military. Reuters said that he reaffirmed his faith in the Indonesian military. The Indonesian military itself, Wiranto and others, said that the U.S. is a friend and that it was a friendly message. What's your take on this?
Well, I think this is one of, you know, they say a stop clock is right two times a day. I think this is a similar situation where for once the Indonesian military is telling the truth. General Sudrajat, who is the Indonesian military spokesman and who until he's a U.S. trained officer, and until recently he was one of the intelligence chiefs for the militia operation in Timor. before being promoted to his current job, he came out with a very clear statement where he said, you know, these public reports saying that Cohen came in and admonished us and threatened us over the militias, this just isn't true. Nothing like that happened in the meetings. Given the inside accounts we now have of the Blair meetings, of the Clemens meetings, of Cohen's own past history of visiting the COPASIS headquarters and praising General Prabowo on his previous visits to Indonesia, this time I'm inclined to think that General Sudrajat and the Indonesian military are telling the truth. President Clinton himself, after all, hinted just a few weeks ago, right after he announced the freeze on military relations with Indonesia, that he hoped to restore that U.S. aid as soon as possible.
We're speaking with journalist Alan Nairn, who's just returned from Indonesia, where he had been held in captivity for a number of days. They said they would try him, and he faced 10 years in prison, but ultimately deported him as he continues to do research on the U.S.-Indonesian military relationship. Alan, when we come back after stations identify themselves, we'll play the response of some of the Congress members to your testimony and revelations last Thursday. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
There is no silence deep enough.
There is no silence deep enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No politician bent enough.
No politician bent enough.
To bury your story, to keep it from us.
Bury your story and keep it from us.
Love from a short distance.
Love from a short distance.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is journalist Alan Nairn, who's just returned from Indonesia and East Timor, where he had been for the last 4 months defying an Indonesian army ban as he continues to expose the complicity of the U.S. military and the Indonesian military. To give Alan's voice a break here, suffering from a lung condition since he has returned, we're going to play some of the response to his testimony by Georgia Congressmember Cynthia McKinney and Chris Smith, who chairs the House Subcommittee on Human Rights that held the hearing last Thursday, where Xanana Gusmao, the rebel leader of East Timor, and José Ramos Horta also testified. Cynthia McKinney, after hearing about the continued U.S.-Indonesian military relationship, started talking about subpoenaing Pentagon officials. This is Cynthia McKinney, and you'll occasionally hear Congressmember Chris Smith, Republican of New Jersey.
I just find it outrageous that we can have witnesses come from East Timor and Australia and we can't get the DOD to come across the street to respond to these very important questions. But this is not unlike a similar situation that I experienced when we tried to hold a hearing on Rwanda, 1 million people dead in the State Department. We had witnesses come from Africa, come from Asia, but the State Department couldn't come across town to testify either. Everybody clams up when we start asking questions that nobody wants to answer. It's no wonder that this government would be against the International Criminal Court because they'd be perpetual defendants at it. There is an evil strain in our international conduct, from assassination to destabilization to fomenting war. That's our legacy around the world, particularly with people of color. There's an evil strain in our conduct. The American people don't even know what is happening, and Congress is lied to. Now, I'm wondering, how high up does this go? Who is the one that's giving Blair and Clemens their orders? Is it directly from the White House? Well, I'm also wondering if we got witnesses from the administration to come here on this particular issue. We have State Department tell us one thing, DOD tell us another thing. They can come here and tell us just about anything, unless they are compelled to tell the truth. And there is a penalty for them lying to us. So under what circumstances can we get them here with a penalty if they don't tell us the truth?
Congressman McKinney, questioning Chris Smith.
The full committee has the power to issue subpoenas, although we could do it as well. We could put witnesses under oath, and there would be obviously a penalty if they lied under oath. And what has been the problem in the past is that we get evasive answers or no shows. And again, we get excuses. Sometimes they're plausible as to why they couldn't be here. For example, DOD suggested that they're all very busy with Secretary Cohen's trip to Indonesia as we speak. So, there's some plausibility to that. But
heck, we don't even know what message he's going to be delivering when he gets there.
But it has been an ongoing stall to this subcommittee with regards to the training of Capasis, and again, Mr. Nair's writings previous, which I used and circulated to embassy officials in Jakarta, U.S. embassy officials, was met with eyes open by several of the people, but by the military attaché and others, it was like nonsense.
Mr. Chairman.
So it's very, very troubling and beguiling.
Mr. Chairman, we, through the work of these witnesses, have some very real evidence. And I don't think we need to let the administration off the hook on this one. I think we need to do anything and everything that's within our power to get to the bottom of what's going on.
Well, you might recall, if the gentlelady would yield, Secretary Taft earlier in this hearing suggested that we write up our question and submit it to the Department of Defense. Secretary Taft has a very responsible, very strategic position as head of PRM, and Secretary Coe as the Clinton point person for the democracy, labor, and human rights. These are very responsible people. They should know, they should want to know, and should want to get to the bottom of any complicity and collusion with the Indonesian military themselves.
I feel compelled to read into the record something from U.S. News and World Report last week because
Arnold
the question
Cohen,
was
human
how
rights
high
activist.
Up does this go in our government?
Yeah.
Now I'm reading to you from the bottom of this piece. While acknowledging the danger of more massacres, President Clinton dismissed comparisons with 1994's genocide in Rwanda. In East Timor, he said, and I quote, "Not everybody has a machete," unquote. And then says here at the end of the newest U.S. News report here, "For those who have already felt the blade's edge and for those who will be cut down in the days to come, that thought is cold comfort." Now, the kind of language that was used from the beginning, Sandy Berger saying, comparing this to his daughter's messy college room, President Clinton saying not everybody has a machete. These are the two top national security officials in this administration. So where does the buck stop?
Obviously, it stops with them.
I mean, this is the kind of language they're using, and this is the tone that's being set.
And my understanding of the political role the White House plays in this is that for years the Pentagon and the State Department and the CIA were unanimous in lockstep in supporting Suharto and in supporting the Indonesian army. It was a very deep institutional commitment from all of them. Then after the 91 Dili massacre, as public pressure increased and as Congress and many of the members here got involved in the issue, there were some changes in U.S. policy. There were various weapons cutoffs, various training cutoffs. Within the past, say, 6-8 months, that pressure from Congress finally did start to affect State Department policy. Better late than never, but it did. Some people, like Ambassador Roy, were quite resistant. He remained one of the old line Suharto Abri supporters, but others in the State Department did start to change. The Pentagon, however, has continued to pursue the old line, and so therefore you have incidents like Admiral Blair just sloughing off the State Department's directive to him, policy directive, to tell Wiranto to shut down the militias. I think the White House role in this is that, of course, in the American system, as opposed to the Indonesian system, where Habibie is completely powerless to stop the militias if he wants to. I think Habibie would like to stop the militias, but he's only the president of Indonesia. And, you know, Wiranto is the one who holds the strings. Here, the president is in charge. And if Clinton wanted to, he could bring Admiral Blair and Admiral Clemens into line in a second. But he sees this and chooses to let it play out. It's a familiar, you know, we've seen it in many other places, a two-track policy, where you have on one track the public admonitions, all those great words from the State Department, occasionally from the White House itself, but on the other, the Pentagon going in and doing business, you know, with the training and the weapons and the so on. And that's, you know, Clinton's and Berger's decision in the end, and they have to be held accountable for that. But first it has to be exposed. So people have to, because there's a false debate going on now, this kind of diversionary debate where people are saying, well, was Clinton too slow to act in backing an international peacekeeping force? Should we do more to intervene? That's not the issue here. This is not a case like Milosevic. When you're talking about Milosevic, you're not talking about someone whose killers are armed and trained and financed from Washington. Milosevic, he got his backing out of Moscow and other places. It wasn't. You can't blame the Pentagon and the CIA and the State Department for Milosevic, at least in terms of backing his killer forces. But you can in the case of Indonesia. It's not a question of the U.S. failing to intervene. It's a question of the U.S. all along having intervened and continuing to intervene on the wrong side, backing the perpetrators. And that's an entirely different matter. And we have to be clear about that because it's much worse, but it's also much easier to stop. You don't have to invade Jakarta. All you have to do is pull the plug.
Alan Nairn testifying before the House Subcommittee on Human Rights this past Thursday. He had just flown in from Indonesia and East Timor. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As he was questioned by the congressmember who runs the subcommittee, Chris Smith, Republican of New Jersey, and Democratic congressmember of Georgia, Cynthia McKinney. Among the others who were there was the Massachusetts Democrat, William Delahunt, also extremely angry about the military relationship that Alan outlined. Alan now joining us in the studio, broadcasting today from Washington, D.C., from Pacifica's National News Studios. Alan, you were talking about the military relationship between the two militaries right up until today. Can you elaborate further, as you laid out in Congress, what some of the programs are that were continuing even as the militias and military were burning East Timor down?
Well, for example, as they were attacking, there were, as the Indonesian troops and militias were attacking in Aceh and attacking in Timor, there were U.S. troops on Indonesian soil engaged in what they called a friendly maneuver, the CARAT exercises, C-A-R-A-T, U.S. Marines who were doing civic actions in the Indonesian countryside to boost the image of the Indonesian armed forces. Also, as the militia attacks were going on, there were Indonesian national police officers being trained at the NYPD, the New York Police Department, the New York Police Academy. They had been brought in under a very adept maneuver through which contacts were made between Indonesian military and police headquarters in Jakarta and various local institutions in the U.S., including the New York Police Department, also including Norwich University in Vermont. These contacts were made with support from the local CIA station in Jakarta and State Department officials in Washington. And they would ship the Indonesian officers and military men over here for training. Right now, Kopassus troops, for example, are being trained at Norwich University in Vermont.
And Kopassus troops are?
Those are the special forces of Indonesia who specialize in torture and disappearance and who oversaw the militias in Timor.
Norwich, the only private military academy in this country?
I've heard that said. I'm not certain. And contacts have also been made with the Fairfax, Virginia Police Department, Los Angeles Police Department, about bringing in Indonesian police and essentially paramilitary people for training there. Also, spare parts and ammunition were being shipped in all along. Ammunition like the Olin Winchester bullets, which were distributed to Battalion 744 in Dili and then distributed to the militias. Spare parts, which enabled the U.S.-supplied Navy ships and U.S.-supplied planes like the Hercules C-130s to keep on functioning as they did their job of shipping forced Timorese who had been taken from their homes at gunpoint and shipping them over to West Timor and other parts of Indonesia where they were essentially held hostages. Also, there have been a whole series of so-called anti-terrorist trainings for the Indonesian military and police. This despite the fact that a few years ago, a confidential U.S. Marine assessment of the situation in Indonesia said that terrorism was a negligible threat there. Of course, it's the Indonesian military themselves who operate as the terrorists. Yet just a few weeks ago, a U.S. intelligence counter-surveillance team was due to go in to Jakarta to provide the military with anti-terrorist trainings. It's a very long list and a very deep and complex relationship. It would take a very long time to lay it out. In the coming days and weeks, I'll be publishing more of this in The Nation magazine and also writing up a detailed report, which will be released with some Republican and Democratic members of Congress. And I certainly hope that the suggestion of Representatives McKinney and Smith and Della Hunt and others that Admiral Blair and Admiral Clemens and other Pentagon officials be subpoenaed and put under oath, that be followed through. It would be a political breakthrough, and it is the next necessary step.
Alan, I want to give you a chance to rest your lungs. We only have a few minutes more of this torture for you, though certainly in different terms than the torture we talk about at the Timorese. But two quick questions. One is, Blair was asked about this, Admiral Blair, what message he sent to Wiranto as a result of your expose in The Nation magazine. What was his response?
Well, he didn't deny it, but he danced around it and said, well, that was a private conversation. Well, it wasn't private. He was speaking as a public official to Wiranto, another public official, and, you know, have the full transcript of what he said.
The other question is, what is happening now in Congress? This possibility of subpoenaing Pentagon officials is very significant, but in terms of bills right now that people can be involved with?
Well, there's a crucial battle going on in Congress right now. Clinton has announced the military freeze for Indonesia, but he clearly was forced into this. He wants to lift it as soon as he can. But there's legislation in Congress on the Senate side from Senator Feingold and Senator Helms and many others, and on the House side from Representative Patrick Kennedy, Representatives Smith and McKinney, and many others, which would lock in legislatively the freeze that Clinton announced administratively. It would make it more thorough. It would also apply to, it would also require the U.S. to oppose IMF and World Bank money for Indonesia until a whole series of rather tough conditions are met on Indonesian military terror in East Timor. The bill is doing very well in the Senate. It should be coming up to the floor for a vote in the next few days. In the House, however, it's facing a tough battle. The bill is now in Representative Ben Gilman's International Relations Committee. It has not yet moved out of subcommittee. However, with enough public pressure and with enough representatives personally stepping in to push it, it does have a chance. That's H.R. 2895, lead sponsor Representative Patrick Kennedy. If that passes, I think it would not only ensure the final exit of the Indonesian military from East Timor, but it would also open the door to democracy in Indonesia. Because right now, brave activists are confronting the Indonesian military on the streets. A number of them have been killed. These demonstrations are likely to increase if the Indonesian military can be weakened by a severing of ties from Washington. It will give the pro-democracy forces on the ground in Jakarta and Surabaya and Medan and elsewhere in Indonesia a real chance. This is extremely important.
Well, Ellen, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Again, that bill in the House, H.R. 2895, in New York Republican Congressmember Ben Gilman's International Relations Committee. The question is, will it get out of subcommittee? Our listeners, you can make the difference. And in the Senate, looks like it's having an easier time, but every call makes a difference. And this is Senator Feingold of Wisconsin and Jesse Helms, North Carolina, Republicans' bill that would also call for an end to the military relationship, military weapon sales, and a cutoff of the IMF World Bank funds. Alan, I'm glad you made a fact safely, and thank you again to all of our listeners who made such a difference, calling the State Department, calling the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta, and even calling into the immigration center where he was being held in West Timor.
I actually was put on the phone. I'm sitting there in immigration detention in Kupang. I actually was handed the phone, and it was a WBAI listener from New York. That was quite an experience, and I think it really shook the interrogators. They didn't know what to make of it.
Well, you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Alan Nairn, journalist, has been our guest and will continue to bring you his exposés on the Indonesian-U.S. military relationship. When we come back, we'll look at health care. A million more people lack health coverage in this country. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The number of Americans who lack health insurance continued to increase last year, climbing to 44.3 million in spite of a prosperous economy and recent government efforts to expand coverage. The ranks of the uninsured grew by about a million in 1998, according to figures that are going to be released today by the Census Bureau, which show the proportion of people in the United States without coverage is still 1 in 6. Joining us to respond to this news are two people. We're going to begin with Claudia Schlossberg, managing attorney with the National Health Law Program, which is an advocacy group based here in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Claudia.
Thank you.
Can you tell us about the latest Census Bureau figures?
Well, I don't think it's a surprise to anybody who's been looking at this problem. One of the things that we've been seeing since enactment of the welfare reform law in 1996 is that low-income families who are moving from welfare to work are losing coverage in the Medicaid program. And those figures have been growing despite the fact that when Congress enacted that law, Congress did not intend for these families to lose Medicaid coverage.
What is the solution right now?
Well, we actually think that there are lots of reasons why people lose health coverage, but particularly for these families, for these low-income families, we think that there are a couple of things that could be done quite readily to stem the tide, as we call it. One of the reasons why so many people are falling off the Medicaid rolls is that states did not correct their systems, their computer systems that link Medicaid coverage to cash assistance. So as families move from welfare to work and lose cash, they're also automatically losing their Medicaid. That's not supposed to happen, and states can fix it fairly easily, as they have done now in Pennsylvania, as they're doing in Maryland, and as they are doing in Washington State. And that will, as we say, stop people from inappropriately losing their coverage. As I said, many of the low-income families are losing Medicaid inappropriately, illegally.
Richard Kirsch is also with us, who's executive director of Citizen Action of New York, which is a grassroots public interest group focusing on health care. Richard Kirsch, at the same time that we are learning about this increase in those without health insurance by close to 1 million, bringing the total to 44.3 million, this report that's out today, Census Bureau, is coming just 3 days before the House is scheduled to take up legislation defining a range of new patients' rights. What's your involvement with that, and what is this legislation?
Well, as you know, Amy, all around the country, the uproar at HMO horror stories has grown and grown, and states around the country have passed legislation. This is a political tidal wave that's reached Congress, and finally, despite opposition by the Republican leadership, there's been so much grassroots effort and so much interesting providers who actually are members of Congress, like this guy Charlie Norwood from Georgia, who's a dentist, and a Republican, and enough resistance to Republicans, there's going to be a floor debate in the House on whether to extend strong managed care consumer protections to the whole country, including lots of people who aren't covered by state law now because the federal law won't allow that to happen. One of the connections here, which I think it's really important to make in this whole debate between these two stories, the HMO industry's whole line against this legislation is will raise the cost of health care and lead to that many more uninsured. And it's really important that people understand that, you know, in 1994 we had this big debate about national health care, and what the insurance industry said and the Republicans in Congress said and the business community said is let the market do its magic. The market will bring down premium rates and we'll have fewer uninsured. And sure enough, when national health care was defeated, there was a reduction in the rate of increase in premiums. A lot of big businesses saw very small premium increases. Small business saw small increases. And yet the number of uninsured still increased, in fact, more rapidly than ever, including mostly working people are uninsured. Businesses are basically are dropping out of the insurance market. They don't think it's important to cover their workers anymore. And so this argument that raising the cost of insurance through regulation, which, first of all, hasn't happened, but even if it did, it doesn't mean anything because businesses are just dropping coverage, and we're talking about working people, and not only real poor people, but middle-income people who are working and can't afford health coverage.
Talking to Richard Kirsch, Executive Director of Citizen Action of New York, and Claudia Schlossberg, Managing Attorney with the National Health Law Program, which is based in Washington, D.C. I was just on C-SPAN this morning, and the overwhelming number of calls were about health care. I mean, here it's a discussion about, you know, all of the issues in the news, and clearly it is number one on people's minds. Now, Claudia Schlossberg, over the last few days, we've heard Democratic contender for president, Bill Bradley, laying out his plan for universal health care so that all people can be covered. Gore, the vice president, who's also running, is sort of attacking him. But how has the Clinton administration done overall? Would you say what would you say?
There clearly have been expansions in coverage for children, which have been very, very important. But I think Mr. Bradley has raised a question and thrown into the discussion, raises a very good question, which is how are we going to cover families? We have changed the safety net in this country, and we're asking people to be independent of welfare and to become members of the working class. But so many of these families moving into the work environment are unable to afford health insurance. Now, while Congress has allowed some expansion for these families for a period of time, there is a point at which they will not be eligible anymore for the Medicaid programs. And we do need to address this, I think, as a country, as a nation. It's a terribly important question, and one that we will be discussing in the next year as this presidential debate heats up.
One of the things that the Washington Post, one of the points it makes, the number of people covered through Medicaid, the government's insurance program for the poor, fell by more than 1 million, probably as a side effect of federal reforms that are moving people off welfare. And the pool of uninsured children remained undiminished despite a major new federal insurance program launched in 97 that was predicted to eventually reach half the 11 million U.S. youngsters who lack coverage.
Well, I think there's a couple of issues there. There's certainly the overall policy question of how do we cover low-income working families and middle-class families. But on the particular issue of Medicaid and these Medicaid expansions, the focus has been on outreach and getting children signed up for Medicaid. But there has not been the emphasis on retention. And what we see repeatedly in every state throughout the country is that children will be signed up for Medicaid coverage, but they will fall off the Medicaid program. In Connecticut, I heard recently, while 4,000 children are signed up every month, 7,000 lose coverage. And again, a lot of this has to do simply with the way the system is designed and set up. We can stop that, and we can do it without legislation. It's simply a matter of restructuring administratively how these programs operate in the state.
Richard Kirsch, I'm going to give you the last word as Executive Director of Citizen Action of New York, where you think the pressure points are now where people can focus the most for health care change reform in this country.
Well, obviously, we need to continue to push for strong patients' Bill of Rights. But the real focus has got to be on universal coverage and making coverage affordable to everyone. And even the best efforts to patch together the system, the kind of administrative changes that Claudia is talking about, and we're also in New York and other states pushing for ways of making healthcare more affordable, are all going to be incremental programs that aren't going to work. And as the Times says, the health experts questioning incremental legislation, because without universal health care, there's not going to be a system where everyone gets covered. And that remains the biggest conundrum facing the country, whether we have the political will to stop putting Band-Aids on and to actually cover everyone. Still a long way from doing that.
I want to thank you both for being with us. If people want to get more information, where can they call?
They can call Citizen Action at 518-465-4600 in Albany, and we have other offices around the state.
That number again?
It's 518-465-4600.
And Claudia Schlossberg, the National Health Law Program?
The number in Washington, D.C. is 202-289-7661. And we also have a website at www.healthlaw.org, and a lot of information about the work that we do is posted on that site.
That's healthlaw.org?
That's right.
Thank you very much, both, for being with us.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move on to our last segment. About 30 people were arrested last week in Minneapolis in the continued fight against the building of a road through Native American land belonging to the Minnehaha Nation. The road is supposed to lead to the Mall of America, the nation's largest mall. The protesters are conducting civil disobedience against the cutting of trees when they were arrested, and they expect a final raid against their camp any time now. We're going to go to the camp to Jimmy Anderson, who is the cultural chair of the Mendota Dakota community. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Well, can you tell us, as you speak to us from your cell phone, where are you right now, and what is this battle about?
Where I am is down in Minneapolis, and it's the south side of Minneapolis by the airport, where it's right next to Fort Snelling, the first fort in Minnesota. And that's built right on what Mendota means in our language is where the waters meet. And to us, it was our creation stories came from right here. And what there's left there in Minnehaha Park, it's the first state park ever in this country, they're going through that park with an unneeded road. And at the end of this park, closer to Fort Snelling, is a spring called Coldwater Spring. And the spring's been running for 9,000 years, and there's 10,000 gallons of water a day comes out of there. And this area, because of these three different water sources there, with the waterfalls of Minnehaha, it was sacred to our people, of course. You know, it's the only river, only waterfall on the whole river basin. and our stories come from there. And there's a green space that's left that they plan on destroying that has that was a burial place of our people and our ancestors.
Jimmy Anderson, can you describe what has happened over the last week?
Yeah, a week ago they came in, a month ago they came into the north end of the park and started to build what they're calling a land bridge, and they started destroying trees. And there's one huge cottonwood tree that's maybe 300 years old that sits right next to the creek there. And our people have been up in that tree protecting it, and that day they were closing the road down to one lane, so we knew that that tree was probably going to be going. So seven people got up there, and the police came, and they started to arrest people on the street trying to stop traffic, and some people had locked down to dump trucks because they're supposed to be monitoring this court-orderly by a judge. It was court-ordered to monitor the ground for any of my relatives' bones or any artifacts that they might find, and they haven't been doing any of this, so we tried to stop them from both cutting the tree and doing that, and they started to cut the limbs off the tree with the people in the tree. One of our young brothers, he's 16, was on a line that went across. There were three lines, and one of them was hooked to one of the branches, and he was hooked to that line when they cut it off. Luckily, it hung up in another branch and didn't pull him down. We were able to get another rope to him.
And so what's going to happen today, perhaps, in the next few hours?
Well, right now they have seven state highway patrol right underneath that tree like wolves waiting for the last rabbit. Three people got taken out of that tree or jumped onto heavy equipment that day that were cutting the branches and were arrested. Another few came down. There's one woman left, Nettle. She's just the strongest woman you could ever meet. She's still up there. She's been up there a full week now today. Last night we tried to... yesterday we had some Catholic nuns ask if they could bring food and water to her, and they were refused. So last night we tried to get one of our people to relieve her by going up and letting her come down and get arrested. And we had her all the way to the tree, and she slipped going up, and they got a hold of her. So she was arrested, too. So we haven't been able to get water or food to her for a week.
Do you expect a police raid right now?
That right now has been... what they've been doing is a lot of these guys are Vietnam vets, and they're using those tactics to attack the trees. Because we can't be in every tree along there, there's probably 1,000 trees that are going to be lost. An oak savanna, one of the few left on the river, or maybe the last one on the river. And they come in and they take 15 to 20 trees, as many as they can, before we hear the chainsaws and are able to get people around there. And then so they don't have confrontation with us, they leave at that point. But the trees, they just leave laying there.
This all for the largest mall in the United States?
Yeah, exactly. They're going to save 3 minutes from their trip to Minneapolis to the mall. I mean, we do need light rail in Minnesota in different areas, but not in this corridor that they picked. It's just it's a boondoggle. They've got $100 million they're paying to reroute this four-lane, 35-mile-an-hour highway when they have one right there. And there's federal laws against this, and they just shun these when we brought them to the judges. They just dismissed us as not having the facts or something. I don't know how they go about doing these things, you know, by breaking their own laws, but they seem to be able to do it readily around here.
Well, Jimmy Anderson, I want to thank you for being with us, cultural chair of the Mendota Dakota community, fighting against the rerouting of road to the largest mall in the United States called Mall of America. Thanks for being with us as we continue to follow that struggle. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love with help from Donna Neiman. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Our website is www.pacifica.org, and you can hear our program if you miss any part of it when you go to that website. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from the nation's capital for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
You a little problem. Not gonna take these houses for a highway. Not gonna harm one limb on these old trees. From now on, this project's gonna...